This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Help may be not so much wanted. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today, 22 September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two words, people. Two words. Holiday and shopping. And now two more words. Seasonal and workers. And look, just because three makes it a trend, here's two more words. Labor and market. We are just now settling into fall, but it's around this time of year that companies do start hiring all those seasonal workers. The National Retail Federation says retail alone hires something near 500,000 temporary workers for the holiday season in this economy. Numbers might be smaller this year, though. Walmart's seasonal hire this year is going to be about 40,000 people, down from 150,000 last year. Hello, uncertain economy and a still tight labor market. So about all that, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going.
A story about seasonal hiring would usually start with me introducing a worker who's weighing lots of job offers, or one who can't get any, or with a company on a hiring spree. Instead, I'm going to introduce you to my inbox and all the emails I got from companies declining interview requests.
Hi, Kristen.
Dear Kristen.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for reaching out.
Thank you for reaching out.
Thanks for reaching out. We aren't able to participate at this time.
It's still a bit early for us on this topic.
Nothing additional to share outside of our hiring article here.
Okay.
And this press release says nothing about how many people they're actually hiring.
This is unusual. September is when data often comes out about seasonal workers. But Andy Challenger at the outplacement firm Challenger Gray and Christmas says there's little movement so far.
We haven't quite seen a lot of announcements yet because we're just in a touch of an uncertain moment.
Right now, retailers feel a bit paralyzed. Consumer spending is strong, but companies aren't sure that'll hold through the holidays because inflation has been so sticky, and they're worried a recession is coming.
They don't want to get into a bidding war over talent heading into a crash, right? It's looming on a lot of their minds.
The bidding war he's referring to is the very tight labor market. Unemployment is at 3.7%, and hiring is especially competitive for consumer-facing businesses looking for hourly workers. Matthew Lavery is the director of talent acquisition at UPS, which is hiring 100,000 seasonal workers this year, with wages ranging from $16 to $30 an hour.
I mean, in the hourly space, people aren't just applying to our job. They're applying to 10 jobs, and there's competition. And I think in some cases, they're shopping.
UPS's strategy to win workers is speed. The company has slimmed its online hiring process down to 25 minutes from application to job offer. 80% of its seasonal jobs won't even require an interview. And to UPS, this is not just some stab-in-the-dark strategy. It's a science.
The quicker that we can get to a job offer to a candidate, the more likely they are to start with us.
50% more likely. And that matters when it's taking UPS 15% longer to fill positions than in past years. Michaels, the arts and crafts chain, is opting for a different strategy. It's hiring 15,000 workers, that's 5,000 less than last year, and promising them more hours. Mary Lynch is a regional director.
It definitely helps us to hire fewer people, and it helps you to keep team members, right? They're here to earn money. The more folks you hire, it spreads the hours out much thinner.
Lynch didn't say this, but it's also a strategy that could theoretically allow a company to downshift hours if sales don't end up being so strong. Alan Benson, a labor professor at the University of Minnesota, thinks more companies will play it conservative this year.
They might try to keep a leaner ship, and then try to make more adjustments on the fly rather than overshoot, promise wage increases, promise, you know, big signing bonuses, and then fall short if indeed the holiday season isn't as hot as they may hope.
For now, it's a bit of a cat and mouse game. Wait it out a bit longer and see how the economy goes before promising to hire. But wait too long and, well, all the good workers might be snapped up. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stock traders are still trying to make up their minds how they feel about the Fed's rate hike yesterday. Bond traders had zero doubts. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This week has been, if you've been paying attention, kind of a central bank rate hike palooza. The Fed here yesterday, of course, we told you about that. The Bank of England, central banks in Sweden, Switzerland, and Norway, everybody is raising rates. The European Central Bank almost surely will when it meets in a couple of weeks. The notable exception, though, is the Bank of Japan. It has decided to keep its rates near zero, and it says it expects that to be the case for some time to come. Japan is dealing with inflation just like everybody else, yes, but as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, the BOJ has got more than rising prices on its mind.
Compared to the dollar, the yen's value has fallen by more than 20% this year. That's in large part because the Bank of Japan has kept interest rates low, while the Federal Reserve has been raising them, and that makes Japanese government bonds less attractive to investors.
So they sell Japanese yen and buy U.S. dollars, so that leads to the yen's depreciation.
Sayuri Shirai is an economics professor at Keio University in Tokyo and a former member of the Bank of Japan's policy board. She says the bank is keeping interest rates low to prop up Japan's economy after the pandemic by helping people with mortgages and business loans.
There are still many small and medium enterprises that are suffering. And so they need to borrow money from commercial banks. So if the interest rate starts to go up, that's very bad for them.
A weak yen can be a good thing, especially for Japanese manufacturers, since it makes their exports cheaper. But Takatoshi Ito, an economics professor at Columbia, says Japanese exports have been slow. Meanwhile, the weak yen is making imports more expensive for Japanese consumers.
So the benefit seems to be less than before, while the costs from the imported inflation, especially energy and food, seems to be high.
The Japanese government is trying to boost its currency by buying yen and selling off reserves of other currencies. But Christopher Vecchio at Daily FX says Japan can only do that for so long.
As those FX reserves wind down, they have less ammunition moving forward to try to prop up the value of the yen, plain and simple.
And as the Fed keeps hiking interest rates, it'll be even harder for Japan to prop up the yen. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
After very nearly 100 days of slow but steady declines, gas prices are going up again. AAA's national per-gallon average bumped up yesterday and again today. Back in March, as you surely remember, as those then sharply rising gas prices started squeezing consumers after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, President Biden authorized the release of crude from the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Well, we learned from the Department of Energy this week that the SPR now has less oil than it has in 40 years, a relatively measly 427 million barrels, down from nearly 600 million at the beginning of the year. Marketplace's Samantha Fields has today's SPR primer.
The Strategic Petroleum Reserve is a rainy day fund for oil.
The goal of it has been to essentially make sure that there is enough supply in times of supply constraints, whether that is due to geopolitical impacts or weather-related.
Matt Smith is an oil analyst at Kepler, a data and analytics firm. He says the U.S. government first created the reserve after the oil crisis in the 1970s, and since then it's come in handy a few times. During the Gulf War in 1991, after Hurricane Katrina in 2005,
So Katrina came through the US Gulf of Mexico, knocked out a lot of production. And so there were SPR releases to supplement US supply then.
There were more releases in 2011 during the Arab Spring,
when there was the disruptions in northern Africa in countries such as Libya.
And this year, Russia's invasion of Ukraine upended the global oil market and prices skyrocketed.
I know you're always worried about running down the rainy day fund, but it's been raining.
Samantha Gross directs the Energy Security and Climate Initiative at the Brookings Institution.
This has been a really big, really important supply disruption, and this is what it's designed for.
The reserves are stored in four different locations on the Gulf Coast, two in Texas and two in Louisiana.
And there are these gigantic salt caverns, so you can't see much on the surface, but underground there are these very large storage areas that we use to store hundreds of millions of barrels of crude.
And even though the administration has been releasing about a million barrels a day, every day, for months now, Gross says, those gigantic salt caverns are still more than half full. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
cool, crisp, and clear. And that's what you call apple picking weather.
Fall is here, in case all the pumpkin spice everything didn't tip you off. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 107 points today, 0.3%, 30,076. The NASDAQ down 153, about 1.3%, 11,066. S&P 500 gave back 31 points, 0.8%, 37.57. Let's do some more energy, shall we? Coming out of Sam's piece, the Energy Information Administration reports natural gas producers are operating more drilling rigs now in the United States than at the beginning of the pandemic back in early 2020. Back then, 112 natural gas rigs were operating. This month, 166 in operation. One of the places, by the way, using a whole lot of natural gas, the Golden State of California, for some brief periods during that heat wave that we had back in the beginning of September, which seemed like it lasted forever. Our grid operator out here used natural gas for as much as 60% of its energy mix that it needed to meet demand. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, thank you, Jay Powell, on this one, rose to 3.71%. How long do you think till four handle on that one, huh? You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The big K-12 education story here in Los Angeles, home to the second biggest school district in the country, it seems relevant to point out, is the ransomware attack that LAUSD was hit with a couple of weeks ago. Since then, Los Angeles and hundreds of districts around the country have called on the federal government to provide better funding for school cybersecurity. So, Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes now on why schools are such attractive cyber targets and what might be done to protect them.
When Timothy Tillman hears about a cyber attack on a big district like L.A., he feels
scared.
Tillman's chief technology officer for Chesterfield County Public Schools near Richmond, Virginia. It has around 65,000 students, so about a tenth the size of the Los Angeles district.
There is an expectation that they would have everything in place, and they still got hit. So what chance do we have?
Tillman, who's part of the group calling on the FCC for more resources, says he has all the problems of a corporation with the budget of a school district. And like all of us, teachers can be vulnerable to messages from hackers.
They are susceptible to things like urgency or to an angry parent demanding an answer.
Another reason schools are vulnerable is they deal with lots of outside vendors, from online textbooks to the guy who delivers the milk, says Doug Levin, who directs the K-12 Security Information Exchange, a nonprofit member association for schools. And when a hack is successful,
school districts themselves may not be able to route their school buses, operate point of sale in the cafeteria to serve lunch. You know, they may not even have control over their security systems.
The industry that's selling all this technology to educators is also selling solutions to deal with cyber attacks, like AI software that promises to stop hackers before they even get in the virtual door. But Leslie Carhart with the cybersecurity firm Dragos says districts also have to invest in tech training.
None of these things are magical. None of them are just going to work by themselves. They require care and feeding.
By cybersecurity professionals who may command high salaries that most school districts can't pay. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
If you're an academic or somebody like me who spends a lot of time talking to academics, you're probably familiar with the personal websites a lot of them have. Academics, actually, and all kinds of other professionals, too, right? There's normally a little about section, a list of recent and perhaps not so recent accomplishments, areas of expertise, awards if they got them. They're kind of like advertisements, those websites are, for a person. But I saw one the other day that was not that. List of accomplishments? None. That's a quote. Core beliefs? Instead of leading, be a follower. Also a quote. Advice for young scholars? This one said, find co-authors who are smarter, more creative, harder working, taller, and preferably better looking than you are. Carl Aquino, a professor of organizations and society at the University of British Columbia. His was the name at the top of that page. Professor, welcome to the program. It's good to have you on.
It's good to be here.
So we should say at the outset here, just to establish your street cred, as it were, you are actually an accomplished scholar in your field, and yet you have this website that I don't even know. Would you describe it for me, please?
Sure. I guess I would describe it as a kind of amusement that I created many, many years ago, but also, I suppose, a kind of satirical statement about some things that I'd observed.
It's something that has to be seen to be believed, but I'll just read the first page here. It's the new official unofficial about me. Welcome to my updated official unofficial homepage. Since 2005, you're visitor number 3. I still have no idea why you've chosen to visit this site, but here are the things you can read about while you are here. What has Carl Aquino failed to accomplish? What advice does Carl Aquino have for young scholars, avid cyclists, expecting parents, and first-time homebuyers? How? Give me the backstory, would you?
Yeah, well, this website was created over 15 years ago. I wanted to kind of do a takeoff of some websites I had seen from fellow faculty, some of them which were rather lavish with self-praise. And I thought, my friend and I thought it would make, I had a friend I was working with at the time, is also a professor, and we thought, this is kind of funny. Maybe we should make an antithesis of this kind of website and, you know, a suboptimally functioning academic. It's just meant to portray someone who doesn't appear to have anything together, but yet is still dispensing advice.
You know, what's funny is clearly it's a goof, right? But number one, you're making a point. And number two, you put a lot of thought into this.
Yes. Yeah, we did. I mean, it wasn't, I worked on it a bit over the years, but I have noticed, because I teach in a business school, I do encounter different students' websites from time to time. And the amount of self-aggrandizement that seems to go into a lot of these personal brands is actually an interesting phenomenon to study. But, you know, my website appears to have stood the test of time because people picked it up again. I don't know how. And I guess that's why you're talking to me now.
That is true. And, you know, we want to boost your brand, Professor. That's why we're here, right?
Well, thank you.
All right. So, look, so satire aside, as a person who studies this stuff, right? I mean, you are a professor of organizations and society at UBC. What do you learn when you go and you explore the way people brand themselves here in the, you know, early 21st century?
I think part of my curiosity about it is the different motives. So there are obviously some instrumental motives. You want to present yourself in a positive light. Perhaps you'll get attention, you'll get opportunities. That said, I mean, I think it's also part of the ethos of our current culture to build a personal brand. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. is building a false brand actually conducive to a life of psychological health and flourishing? I guess the jury's still out on that.
Yeah, there was a whole hue and cry in the journalism community just a number of months ago about journalists who build personal brands and whether that takes away from their work and what value it adds to the journalism that they do. So it's not, right? It's not just academia. It's freaking everybody out there.
Oh, yeah, I think this is a phenomenon that certainly 15 years ago was not at the level that you see now. And I do think that this is maybe just part of business as usual in the age of social media.
You're going to keep it up? I mean, there's no reason to take it down, right?
No, like I said, it seems to have had pretty good shelf life. And, you know, if it provides people with a little bit of humor and amusement. But I think if you read it, there's actually a deeper message in the whole thing that it's meant to illustrate the vanity of human pretensions. that I think it does speak to, you know, how transitory our lives are, and perhaps attaching extreme self-importance to ourselves and our accomplishments may not be something that will necessarily bring the best out of us. And that's kind of a deeper analysis of it than probably most people will look at. But anyway, that was part of the motivation.
Look, I asked, and you gave a good answer. Professor Carl Aquino is a professor of organizations and society at the University of British Columbia. He is also, according to his website, the 56,651st most influential management thinker in the world. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
The autumnal equinox arrives today, which means fall is officially here, which also, among other things, means farmers are gearing up for one of their busy times of the year. We had Al Rose on the program a couple of years ago. He's a fourth-generation farmer at Red Apple Farm in Massachusetts, and we got him back on the phone the other day for an update.
Well, it's, I think, safe to say it's been a crazy couple of years. You know, coming back to whatever the new reality is. And as a business, you're, you know, especially being an agricultural business, you're always adapting. And it seems like it's just been a lot of adaptations. And in labor for most businesses has been a struggle. And I think we're definitely on the other side these days and feeling very positive. We have a seasonal fluctuation with our business. So, you know, our staffing needs definitely change by the season. But it just seemed the labor pool was very difficult and it was very hard to retain employees. And I think there was just a lot of folks were looking at trying new jobs. but you know, we held on to some poor employees, and over time we've added new employees. And I think, you know, COVID made us stronger. You know, you never want to look at any struggle as anything but a struggle. But in the end, I feel we benefited on many levels. I think we're just much more productive and more efficient, and I would say more focused. Supply challenges, it's almost a running joke around here when we talk about, you know, whatever the current stage of our business is and the things that we're doing and moving from one season to the other is there seems to be so many obstacles of getting supplies here at the right time. For example, jar goods, and, you know, you have to take any kind of delivery into consideration when you're pricing something, and you don't even know the delivery charge until you actually receive things, because it seems it just been so much fluctuation. So we're a sort of a price elasticity where, you know, we can only charge or feel comfortable charging so much. And we definitely want to make sure we're pricing competitively and accurately. And it's a moving target. Happy to say we had a really strong summer. And this weekend, I'm happy to report we have what's called the three C's, the cool, crisp, and clear. And that's what you call apple picking weather. And literally, it's like a little switch on the back of somebody's head that turns on and says, I'm going apple picking. And we are definitely predicting a very busy weekend. We're really blessed and lucky that in the fall, everything that we do is associated with for having a fall experience, whether it's sipping hot cider or picking apples or picking pumpkins. And we like to think that we're responsible for high demand, but it's really the weather that we need to not only grow the crop, but also to sell the crop.
Al Rose, Phillipston, Mass., Red Apple Farm. This final note on the way out today, in which there is some relief for would-be homebuyers in this economy. Saw this on Bloomberg. Research out from Redfin about slowing home price increases. Haven't heard me say that in a while, huh? And where those slowing price increases are happening. Basically, out west is where. Seattle, Las Vegas, San Jose, San Diego, and Sacramento are the top five. In Seattle, in August, the typical home sale brought 5% more than it did a year ago. The year-on-year price increase 6 months ago, 23%. All right, off we go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. I'll tell you what, say what you will about the NFL. Boy, it sells. Amazon said today that 13 million people watched its first broadcast of Thursday Night Football last week. I guess it's a stream, actually, right? Not a broadcast? Anyway, a lot of people. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.